This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tab, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/us/getQR code.
Welcome to episode 119 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today, we welcome Artie Shepherd. Artie was in bands like Bad Trip, Mind Over Matter, World's Fastest Car, Air Type 11, Gay for Johnny Depp, Instruction, Godfires Man, and Unwed. He's also been running a metal bar venue called St. Vitus in Greenpoint, Brooklyn that's held some legendary shows. He's been running that since 2011. He is still playing music. He's in a band called Primitive Weapons because obviously he's not giving up on his dream. Artie has seen a lot in music, and with no punches pulled in this interview, tells it how it is. I love talking to him about music. I probably laughed more through this than any other that I've ever done. Thanks to our Patreon supporters, and thanks to everyone that picked up the book, Anthology of Emo Volume 1, anthologyofemo.com. This is episode 119 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Artie Shepherd.
What's funny about that is that I went to Airwaves Festival in Iceland 3 weeks after 9/11.
Really?
Yeah, and got incredibly drunk on the plane and just started throwing bottles behind us, airplane bottles. Because I was so nervous to fly.
Delta 522 to...
Yeah, it was such a bad scene. I was such an asshole that me and this dude, Kevin McManus, it was really funny. And then we had to spend the entire weekend with all these people who we just pissed off on the airplane.
Wow.
And they'd just be like, oh, it's those dicks. And like, yeah, hi. Guess we should go to the penis museum in Reykjavik. I don't know if CMJ happened. I'm sure it probably didn't.
Because it was always an EVR showcase, and I have the posters, so I just can't remember if that was actually... But yeah, this one's hilarious.
Where? Oh, that's a tour.
It was like they did those little like, yeah. This was actually
and the Strider headlined.
That's what we're all wondering. I can't. Every time someone comes in and knows the bands, they can't understand why. But I feel like
it might have just been like they just listed them, and maybe they because S Friends or Us or Coheed. I don't know where Coheed was at that point in their career.
I think
career,
that was pretty new for them.
Yeah.
Huh. Anyway.
Well, they're listed first here, so
they definitely opened that one.
Yeah. They played my bar. They were good.
Good kids.
Very nice. Good kids. It's all right.
So, Artie, you're here, finally.
Yes, I'm here.
We have randomly seen each other over the years. We met. I think you forgot. I was always like, I like to mention this. The song for Air Type 11, Better Than the Super Bowl,
yes,
was named at the show I was at, which I always feel really special about.
I mean, that's just incredible to me. It was in
North Carolina,
right? And
533 Uprising.
533.
An absolute shithole.
It was somebody's house.
No, it was like, wasn't it? It was like a strip of like a downtown Main Street. And it was like there was a bucket to catch the water that was raining in from the leaks in the roof.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And the person who actually named it, I gave a shout out to on the album. So it was.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because I used to do little commentaries underneath.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And I remember that show because we brought our own. We would do the Guided by Voices thing and bring a cooler of beer, and we were just handing beers out to people, which we probably shouldn't have been doing now that I'm a bar owner. We gave a shout out like in the commentaries underneath each song. I would always write like how the song was written, where the title came from, stuff, you know, real emo-y stuff like that.
Yeah.
Even though the stuff I wrote wasn't very emo-y, but that's all right.
As an old hardcore kid, come on.
Well, I know. Well, we weren't very emo-y, so, you know, we tried.
So, were you born on Long Island?
I was, yeah. I grew up, I lived on Long Island until I was 22. And then my parents unceremoniously said,
"See you later.
We're leaving. Fuck you. Get out." And I was like, all right, cool. They gave me till 22 to finish college. I didn't finish college. I just left and went on
Where'd
tour.
Where'd you go?
I went to Hofstra. I hated college. It was boring as shit. I went to Chaminade, which was like a college prep high school on Long Island. And that
Is that where you met a lot of people?
No, not at all, actually. My metal friends, yeah, like, because that's what primarily I was into in high school. It's, you know, I was pretty typical, like, you know, metal, hardcore, you know, then Britpop came and just kind of wiped that all away. Not really wiped it away, but it's always been there. I do own a metal club, but
yeah,
I like a lot of different things. I like music, yeah, in general.
But then early on, like, were you playing... Did you find the guitar yet? Like, when did that, like, singing?
Yeah, I started playing. My mom had a guitar, and she was left-handed, and I was left-handed. So it was easy for me to just pick up and start playing, and I would learn, like, little chord stuff. I started writing almost the second I picked up a guitar. I was never very good at playing cover songs, so I would just write my own stuff. And I think that's pretty typical of a lot of punk and hardcore dudes. Like, they just, you know, they're not playing Van Halen songs. They're kind of just like, hey, this sounds pretty cool. I like the way this sounds.
It's,
you know,
almost like they're too, I don't know. My brain was always like, I don't want to learn that song. I want to learn mine.
Right. Yeah. And it's, there's something rewarding about finishing a song and all that. But yeah, I played in metal cover bands. There's actually stuff online of us playing in 1988. I was 15. That's really funny. And, then I had back surgery. I was a bit of a jock, not a jock, but like, I mean, they called me the devil worshiper on the baseball team. It was like, with my testament to legacy. I played center field, but I mostly sat on the bench because I was like a super all-star little league player. And then the field got big and I didn't. And I didn't hit puberty till I was about 16. So I was 4'11" when I got into high school.
Holy shit.
And when I tried out for the team, it was just like, this kid can't hit it past the pitcher, you know? And I went from like throwing the equivalent of like 85 miles an hour to holy shit, this is big. And so I never really caught up. And then I had a tumor on my spine, which I had to have removed, which
in high school.
Yeah. Which the positive part of that was I never had to take gym again. So I had like six extra study halls a week or something, which was awesome. Cause
that's
I would
rad.
Get all my homework done.
Yeah.
And then I'd have all my free time afterwards, which was, it was really a blessing. Yeah, Long Island, like, you know, I guess it was around I was going to a club called Sundance a lot. It was in Bayshore, which is was sort of the Long Island equivalent of Lamore's, which is another famous metal club, except it was a lot smaller because Long Island's more of a secondary market. And basically, I met a lot of people there. So I met Ed Reyes. I met Ed Reyes and Scott Martin. Scott might not be familiar to everybody, but he plays in Silent Majority when they do play. And he was in, he's in Greensleep. But he was in Airtype on the first record. And he was really young, but I met Scott through a mutual friend. And then Scott introduced me to Ed and, General George, who was a singer of Clockwise. And we were probably 14 when we met, and we used to go to Sunrise Mall with a boombox and like listen to
no way
sick metal and like, you know, it would be
how
so
did you first meet though? Was it at a show? Was it like you
no,
saw
no,
a t-shirt? It was just mutual friends.
Yeah, it was like Scott just introduced me to Ed because Scott knew I was really into underground stuff like Merciful Fate and Voivod and you know, like, and I've always been like a searcher of music, like I just wanted heavier and faster and heavier and faster. And he introduced me to Ed. We all hung out one night. Paul Brinkman as well, the original bass player of Silent Majority. And we just started hanging out a lot, like a lot. And it was super fun. We would go to shows and we'd go to Sundance. One day we decided we wanted to start a band. And we're like, yeah, let's do it, man. Yeah, we play guitar. And I fucking sucked. And Ed kind of sucked too. And it was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And we handed out flyers at Sundance at the show. And we got a call from John LaFada, who later became the drummer of Mind Over Matter and Neglect and Madball and Sheer Terror he's been in. He was really fucking young. I think he was 13.
Wow.
And we tried out this. Then we started trying vocalists. And the first time we went to John's basement, like there was this whole group of kids from Lindenhurst that were hanging out all the time. And it was George Reynolds, Artie Philly, just like the Sound Majority kids eventually. They were super young too. And we tried out this kid, Mike Richardson. He didn't work out. Then we tried out George, and he worked out. And we sort of solidified the lineup at that point until we threw Ed out.
And that was Mind Over Matter, or was that with Bad Trip?
That was Mind Over Matter. I wasn't in Bad Trip until a little bit later. I missed all the youth crew stuff, and I probably wouldn't have joined the band.
That's what I'm saying. You probably wouldn't.
Yeah, not my thing at all. I think it's stupid. I think it's stupid now. I think it was stupid then, but whatever. Teach his own. I don't really care. Do what you want. Come play my club. It's cool. No one's going to drink anyway. So. No one's gonna drink. Although the last Judd show did really well. I was happy with that.
That's like a whole... you could do a whole like... how much alcohol was sold for what straight edge band?
Oh, yeah, no, the Judge. H2O was the worst. We did five nights of H2O, and it was like we shouldn't even open the bar. It was pointless. I was like, really? Like, these guys walk with this much money, and we made nothing, and like, yeah, anyway. I love you. I love all the guys in the vet. Like, that's the thing is, I'm friends with all these people for years, so I love it. It's great. And you know, they don't have to love my band. I don't have to love their bands. I just love them as people. I love them part of the community and the scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like my favorite band ever is Yes. So you can't expect me to sit there and listen to, like, a youth crew song and think that it's interesting, you know? But I will support what you believe in. And I'm, you know, and I get the art in what you're doing. It's just different than the art that I love. So that's all.
But Mind Over Matter, I mean, I grew up in Vermont, and that was in high school around that time. Yeah. And that you heard that name.
Well, like, we played up there a lot.
But I'm saying, like, that was rad. Like, it was something I was hearing that was not from my town. It wasn't in the dumb Metal Maniacs magazine or whatever. And it was like, it was that same thing about, I don't know anything about them. You had to, like, go search. You had to go ask the older guy at the show, who were they?
Wait, who's that? Who's the guy from
Burlington,
Vermont?
The older guy? At every show?
Youth of Today manager. Oh, my God. Sammy Siegel did the best imitation of him. You would do the Killing Time tour.
I don't know who that is.
Oh, fuck. What's his name? He managed Youth of Today.
Really? He's from Vermont?
He's from Burlington, Vermont. Yeah. He was, I think he was a cross-dresser, and he was in the military.
Did he go to 242? Did he go to the shows?
Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. I wish I could text Mike Gatti right now. Really. it's going to come to me. It's going to come to me at some point. I was just going to text Sam and ask him.
We'll edit it in
the minute. My God, it's so fucking funny. Anyway.
But that same thing of that search and discovery, you know, finding other people like that. It's like when you meet someone and they mention four bands, instantly I can tell if I'm going to be down because it's not them mentioning something that's on the radio.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, up until Nirvana hit, that was the way it was. And once Nirvana hit, then everything changed. It was like, you know, we went from playing. I remember very vividly this experience of another. I don't think Artie Philly will remember Artie White now. Remember that he always denies that he said it, but he did say it. And it was like our first 7-inch came out right around after Nirvana hit, and like all these alternative dance nights started popping up. And that was where we had been doing shows in bars and during the day and shit like that on Long Island. Tyler King would do them and whatnot. And it was cool. And it was fun, but there was probably 20 people, the same 20 people for years. Like people like Scott Weingard, Norm Arenas, they were all from Long Island, and they would go to shows. Those guys were a little bit more worldly than us. So all of a sudden this happens. We had our record release show for the first Mind Over Matter 7-inch, which I can't possibly listen to. And we were like, really, I remember remember getting going to Rec Age Records when they signed us, and it was like Ed was still in the band, and I remember walking outside. It was, they had this beautiful office on West Broadway, and I was like, guys, anything we write from here on out is going to be put out on record. That's incredible. And you know what? For me, actually, for most of us, I was right. I don't think any of us ever did a demo again.
Yeah.
But yeah, then that happened. We had our 7-inch record release at the Angle in Mineola, and 400 people showed up, and we were like, "What the fuck?" And it was really the beginning of the sort of like explosion of Long Island hardcore, because we really wanted to create a scene that was different. We were sick of the shit that was going on in the city. They didn't respect us, you know. And eventually they did, because they had to.
They had to.
Yeah, but like, but that was the thing, is that like once the Angle started and Artie was booking all these shows and we lived together, so I was like sort of involved, and we booked the Souls and we booked a Shift and we booked like there was this whole coming together of those two scenes that happened over the next couple of years, and it was really, we booked Life of Agony, we booked like, it was really eclectic. We'd have Neglect and Garden Variety on the same show, which I loved. We loved doing that shit. It was so much fun.
I love talking about that thing of, you see the show flyers, and even, you know, I remember seeing one, this is later, but it was like Snapcase, Dashboard Confessional. And it was like that, because they were from
the same, I
remember
when Dashboard
ilk.
Was doing all those that stuff, and it was, at the time, I thought it was a really smart marketing move, because he stuck out so much. You know, and there were a lot of girls in the scene, too, and frankly, you know, it's hard for me to believe like that there was 300 girls that were like, I love Converge, you know, like and that's not me being sexist. Maybe that's just me talking from my time period, because I see lots of girls. My business, I can actually see from the analytics what my business does.
You have,
it's
everyone,
like 70% guys and 30% girls. The Bouncing Souls taught me the best lesson in the world. I remember they played the Angle the first time, and there were fucking more than 50% girls there.
Really?
And the guys were like, you could just see the guys like, wow. I was like, so wait, if girls come, that means more guys will come. Like, this is great. These guys are geniuses. And it wasn't, they weren't, it was just the style of music they played. They changed a lot from that time, but just the people that they were. And it was like, I think a lot of people were just discovering that style of music at that time. It was like all the Guidettes with the hair straight up, all of a sudden their hair was down and they were going to Lollapalooza. And then slowly but surely, you know, they ventured into our scene. And it was like, it was really a cool, eclectic group of people. And the music, to me, more than anything, the music was fucking great. And that was like, that was the one thing that I think Mind Over Matter was able to offer, was a band that was sort of like, by the time we got to, on even Security is a weird record, but by the time we got to Automupulation, which was the last record we did, we weren't even remotely a hardcore band. I mean, we were, it was such a mixture of stuff that you couldn't really pin down what it was, but we were considered a hardcore band. People called us progressive hardcore, same thing they did for Burn.
Yeah.
But once you call something progressive hardcore, it's not hardcore anymore. Madball is hardcore. That's always going to be hardcore, you know? And like, that's not, like, I got really into songwriting, and I got really into, like, George didn't scream. And which was really separated us a lot. And at the time, it was hard for us to get accepted amongst the Resurrections and the Snapcases and all that stuff. But it was cool. And that, I mean, you know, hopefully when the documentary comes out, which should be relatively soon, people will be able to see what it was like. It was really wild. And after Modern Matter broke up and I moved to Queens and joined World's Fastest Car with Walter, like, the PWAC opened towards the end. I guess it was probably open for about a year.
When did that open?
I think in 95, 94. Okay. No, like I quit Modern Matter in 95, and the PWAC opened, I think, in 94. But like, shit just went through the roof at that point. And the bands got really good.
Ron was showing me mutual friend Ron Richards. He was showing me some flyers today. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen any of them. It was unreal. Like, everyone on the show, it was like, they were like huge bands.
Yeah, well, what began to happen, because there was no place to play in the city, bands were coming out to Long Island because there was a scene. And I think,
do you think that helped?
There was a shift.
Progress Long Island even more because of the void with them not being able to play the city.
Absolutely.
They're playing Long Island now, and you're getting exposed to more.
Well, you're going to get, you're exposed to more people. Like, there was a shift of hardcore.
Not just shift behind you. But
there was a shift of hardcore from the city to the suburbs. And that's really the sort of like core of emo, honestly, was that shift. Is all those bands, none of those bands are, they're all from the suburbs, you know, or upstate of the Midwest. You know, I think the Midwest had a huge influence, especially like Midwest indie rock, which people would call emo. Who the fuck knows? It's such a weird term. But the, yeah, it was, you could see it happening. And, you know, bands like Earth Crisis or even Shelter, like, you know, you'd go play in Albany after Shelter had been there and everybody's wearing Krishna beads for a week. You'd go to down south after Earth Crisis there and everybody's a vegan for 2 weeks, you know? It was
in Windbreakers.
Yeah, in Windbreakers, yeah. or Hatebreed played and everybody's in basketball shorts. Yeah, it was, you know, but it was cool. And there was a really, Long Island had really strong connections with certain places. North Carolina, we had really strong connections with. Why was that?
Do you know? Because that's where I went to end up going to school.
Well, in Winston-Salem, there was Big Dave's Club, and we just, like, the bands would just go back and forth. It was like a thing, like Code 7 would come and play Long Island. And, like, that was the other thing, is that we had the ability to trade. I mean, the fucking bands that played on Long Island, like, even after the PWAC at Deja One and whatnot, it's incredible. You know, like, bands that got huge, at Dillinger, first time they played, I forget what fucking year it was. I mean, they just sold out Terminal 5 in about a minute, you know? I mean, granted, it's their last show, but...
But still.
You know, I wish I was playing it. I'm down. We just toured England with them. But yeah, it was an interesting time, and...
But because of the... I love that time period, because I think for us, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have things quick sometimes, and then all of a sudden, things are starting to speed up. We got email. We check it more than once a day.
The message boards. The message boards were the first things.
Bridge 9, Trustkill.
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, those are the days of fanzines, too, which were, you know, a lifeline, honestly. And me and Artie did a fanzine. We did a radio show together. Like, we were kind of, and he booked all the shows on Long Island, so we were kind of, like, filtering through things.
Yeah.
You know? And also playing things that we wanted people to get into. Like, we purposely wouldn't play, like, 25 to Life. You know what I mean? Like...
But playing that different stuff, like you said about the shows, exposing people, because most times someone going to a show, they're not just into Madball. They actually like other things.
Absolutely. Well, they're music fans. Anybody who gets into, I mean, the Morrissey Smiths thing is the biggest example of that. You know,
what does that explain that?
Well, how weird is it? You know, like, I mean, I know it was a certain, like, you know, Wally has a lot to do with it, you know, and whatnot. And even the Bad Trip guys who saw the Smiths really early on.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Like, they, Quicksand covering How Soon Is Now really changed the game for a lot of people. It made it okay. Quicksand in general just changed the game. But it was like, it very much so, there was an outsider idea. And a music nerd idea. You know what I mean? Like, if you were into hardcore, you were really into music. You had to be. It's the only way you knew about it.
You couldn't just do a quick search.
No. You had to really be into it. You had to do your research. You had to, like and do a lot of legwork, go to shows, go to fucking see distros, all the shit.
Yeah.
Go to record stores in the city, because at the time that was really, you know, the only option to find certain things. And, you know, it was fucking Looney Tunes. I remember the first time. All right, so my first show with Bad Trip was the first Dayton Straight Edge Fest. And I forget, I'm sure it's changed names over the years and whatnot. And I remember we hit Black Ice and almost died in Pennsylvania. It was a whole fucking thing. I drank for about 18 hours before getting there, and which was pretty typical of me. And I got out stinking of booze, and I walk into this place, and it's like 600 fucking kids. And like half of them are wearing their Straight Edge Varsity jackets. And everybody's selling their merch. And like the first band on that day was Lincoln.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, and like, it was Lincoln and what's the band? Hoover.
Holy shit.
Avail. Yeah, I have the flyer on my it's on my laptop. But and the night show was like Fountainhead and Into Another and Resurrection. Earth Crisis was the first band on at the night show. And people were throwing hamburgers at them. That shows you how the scene changed after them. And it was like really Snapcase played, I believe. It was just eye-opening. You know, I had toured in Europe a bunch, but I hadn't done a lot of American touring. And I was like, wow, this is fucking crazy. Like, you know, there were bands, like, that were sort of changing, like Lincoln I mean, unfortunately, now I listen to it, and I'm like, this guy can't sing to save his fucking life, but neither could most of the emo band singers. But, like, you could really hear things starting to change. Lifetime played. You could hear things starting to change, and, like, there was the really, really heavy, but there was also this melody rolling in. And I always say that emo was a bunch of hardcore kids trying to play rock who couldn't sing and couldn't write songs. And, you know, eventually some of them got really good. That's why it took so long for it to kind of go to a more of a mainstream idea, but they were playing stuff that was melodic enough to be mainstream. It just wasn't executed properly, you know?
Yeah, I know. It takes that first few bands to do it, and then the other people watch them, and then they kind of improve on right. it and keep going.
Right, and then we get into the world of Hot Water Music, and then that takes us to Take 'Em Back Sunday, and that is where, you know...
Which also is the connection with North Carolina.
Yeah, oh yeah, big time. Yeah, obviously. But Take 'Em Back Sunday took what Hot Water Music was doing and did it in more of a radio rock way, and their timing was perfect, you know. So, like, it's interesting. Like, they people talk about, like, at the time as well as, you know, like, all these bands are getting signed from Long Island. Is there a Long Island sound? I was like, yeah, there is actually the Long Island sound, but but no, there isn't. It's every band is
sorry,
different.
That was funny.
Every band is different, you know, and every band, you know, that weren't Taking Back Sunday clones. You know, like, Bayside to me didn't sound like that, or like some of the, From Modern Ashes didn't sound like that. Like every band was, Silent Majority was basically where they were all getting it from, and no one fucking heard Silent Majority.
I hear so much from Silent Majority from all those bands.
Oh yeah,
like, you just
Glassjaw. I mean,
you just feel it in it.
Yeah, Glassjaw is a good example of that. You know, like, Daryl's vocal style was very much Tommy Cargan meets HR meets Chino. You know, it's he's an incredible talent. Like, ridiculously talented human. The whole band is, I don't know who's in it anymore, but yeah, it's like, it's really,
so being there in Long Island, seeing more people come to shows.
I fucked off in 1995.
You were gone for like 2 years, right?
No, I was gone, period. I moved from Queens to Manhattan to Brooklyn, and then I never went back. I would go back for shows. I went back to see Fugazi. I went back for a couple of things that had happened, but for the most part, I was a city kid at that point, and I was working at a record store on Bleecker Street called Rebel Rebel. And this is when Airtype 11 started. And I then got hired at a stock photography agency called Photonica, and quit to go on tour, and basically just lived off of, I don't know. My rent was so cheap. We all lived together, and my rent was super cheap, and I just was like dicking around, honestly. I should have been doing something. I should have been thinking about my future, but I was really living in the moment and enjoying it. And I really truly believe that that band was writing songs that were way superior to any of the bands that we played with, and, you know, that were way more popular than us. So, you know, what I missed was that those bands were making a connection that I wasn't making with people. And I can only say that in hindsight, you know, but I used to say, what, do you just feel bad for him because the guy can't sing? Like, what? Is that why you buy the records? Yeah. I'm so confused.
Do you look cute?
But that was douchey, you know? It's like, but I also, like, on those first couple of tours, it worked in New York. I would be a dick on stage, a total fucking, like, say, like, really sarcastic shit. And it worked here. You know, we would sell out shows. People fucking loved us. I'd go someplace else and they fucking hated me. Like, I was the plague. And eventually, you know, the rest of the band just like, dude, you have to say that stuff on stage. And I'm fucking 12 beers in on yeah. stage, wondering what the fuck I'm doing in a basement in Rapid City, South Dakota, going like, I thought these songs were better than this shit. You know, I did it anyway. This is great. So we played in Lubbock, Texas. All right. And
was this the first record for Airtype or second?
Yes, I think. No, it had to have been amplified.
Do you know what's funny about the first record? I got it in the mail at the radio station, didn't know anything, put it on, and it was one of my first memories at that station, like, liking a record. Like, usually I needed to, like, hear somebody tell me something, but I put it on and I was like, holy shit.
Self-discovery. Beautiful.
Yeah, but then it was like, some records had a cool logo. I knew it had connection to the, but it was fun that I think, I don't know, that moment of getting it.
I'm glad to know you got it. That's nice to know, because we went on tour.
And no one had it?
No. The CD company that printed the CDs printed a breast cancer awareness CD-ROM on the actual CDs. So we had sold, who knows how many.
Because they're they're in the plastic. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're fucking... people didn't actually get to hear the music.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fucking great. I think some actually wound up suing the manufacturers, but like it felt like I was like, wow, I just spent like, you know, a whole 6 months touring and not working, and like, and it was a fucking total waste of my time.
Wow.
Sweet.
So Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah, I don't even know if I want to tell this story, but I this guy wanted to do a shot-to-shot contest with me, and he wound up passing out and throwing up, and then somebody in our crew tried to escort his wife to the van, and then I got blamed for it. And our booking agent at the time was Imakai's sister, Amanda.
How did that happen?
She booked bands.
Really?
Yeah. And like,
was it through the connection with some records?
No, I honestly can't remember how it all came.
Cool.
We did stay with her one night, and she's got all of test pressings of the Discord records.
Wow.
We were like, wow. It's like, should we just take them and run? It was pretty fucking cool. Yeah, and she wound up dropping us because these incidents kept happening with a fucking roadie.
But think about if that was now with like
I got
social.
Blamed for everything.
Oh,
though. That was the thing. It's
everything.
Like fucking yeah. These kids would write these fanzines and be like, oh, and I'd be like, listen, just because like I say wise ass shit on stage doesn't mean like we do dishes and fold clothes, man. You know, like we were incredibly respectful. To if you're opening up your house to us, like kidding me. And I don't know why every fucking kid we stayed with had a hot tub.
Really?
Yeah. Like, we stayed with this one kid. I fucking can't remember where it was. He had, like, taxidermy. His parents, like, were big game hunters. It was, like, taxidermy.
But a
like,
hot tub.
You know, in a fucking, like, case. With, like, in a huge hot. It was fucking weird. So weird. Anyway.
They have more room for things done in the South.
They do,
West.
Yeah.
Actually, everywhere but where we live.
Yeah. Where we live, you got to work twice as hard and have
less.
Quarters of as much. Anyway. But yeah, so I mean that's cool to hear that you had that discovery. That makes me feel good about that time because it was
I probably
hard.
Went to that first show. I probably whatever that first one was, it with that Big Dave spot.
I can't remember which show we played, but I mean, yeah,
it was 533. But those I miss like I didn't know what you looked like. I just knew like how you sounded.
Right.
So I loved the. Going somewhere and not knowing something.
Yeah.
And that's what I miss now. Like, I mean, if I'm going to your venue or something, or I'm going to look up the band, listen to them, watch a YouTube video. It's like, I'm already have a notion before I go.
Yeah.
And then I miss that about discovery, about maybe I had randomly met you, but we're not going to see, we didn't exchange numbers. I didn't find you on Facebook right after. Maybe it was a letter.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds like I sound old, but there was a sense of there was patience Kevin Lyman. But more of the I had a moment to think and I was listening to your record and I remember that last song, the one that's like 20 minutes where it's like
oh, it's got all the space
yeah,
in between.
But is it Frop P or
Frop P, yeah.
Like that's a fucking great song. Like I don't think I would listen to that as much now if I was streaming. I don't know. I just feel like that.
It's so funny. In the digital age, that song is super annoying because it's got all that space.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden there's that other
there's
shit.
There's the rap. And
yeah.
I think it's Mike Gitter, the A&R guy who signed Jawbox singing Static.
Yeah.
That was great. That was super fun.
But that, like, you know, you guys are, you've got MapQuest directions printed out or whatever that is. Not like those kind of, or you got a map out.
That was the crazy part about touring places like, in Europe in like 1992, 93, 94, you just like it was so odd to me to be like 19 years old. The first time I went over was with Bad Trip, and I was like, wow, we got out of the plane, and somebody came to pick us up. We were 4 hours late for the first show, and all the kids stayed till 2 a.m. to watch us. And it's like, you know, anything could happen to us. Like, it might ever matter had a fucking shotgun pulled on us in East Germany. Because there were these neo-Nazi guys who were pissed off at the driver for driving Americans around. And they were talking in German, and the driver just turned to me and he's like, get in the fucking van now. And I was like, guys, we got to go. And Artie toured with us all the time. And Artie and John LaFada, and like they're like, hey, like everybody's drunk and having fun. And he's like, get in the van now. And, and I was like, guys, let's go. Otto's pissed, like something's wrong. So we get in the van and I see the guy go to his trunk. He opens up his trunk and he starts pulling out a gun. And Artie and John had gotten these stupid switchblades because they were legal there.
And they're going, fuck you, Nazi. Like, hanging out the door, like, with their switchblades. And Otto's, like, putting the car in gear, like, fucking leaving now. We're leaving now. He was completely freaking out. We just pulled away, and the guy's pulling out his gun. We were like, what? He's like, I don't know if they're going to follow us or not. Like, and then he started telling us what they were saying. And, like, just experiences like that were so fucking crazy. Like, man, that just happened? Like, playing a weird basement in Prague, you know? Like, all these, like, and John was probably 17, you know, we played this airport hangar in Florence, Italy, that was just fucking insane. They were building a stage because Fugazi was coming. Like, yes,
wow.
Fugazi. Well, actually, no one spoke English. They took us around Florence, but those experiences were priceless. And we thought, like, you know, and I've been told this by, like, the Sound Majority guys or, like, other people, like, we were the first band really to go and do that from Long Island, and they're like, you guys showed us that it was possible to leave here. And I was like, dude, the idea that I could fly to another country and have people come and see my band is fucking mind-boggling. Like, that was back then. Now it's like,
that's what I'm getting at. Like, there's
so much
somewhere.
Noise, it's actually harder.
Yeah. No, you're going all this distance, and there's a kid there that knows every word.
It's fucking nuts. It's in a crazy.
How did that happen?
Crazy experience. Like, so this is another one. So when I was in World's Fastest Car, which most people don't know what that is, but when Quicksand broke up, and Walter had asked me before they broke up that I was the only person that knew they were going to break up, that he asked me to play in a band with him. And he had his deal with Island Def Jam, and I was like, yeah, this is, man, what the fuck? Of course. Yeah. I broke up Mind Over Matter. And another podcast in itself, even though it was only like a year and a half. But we went to Japan, and we were in Osaka. We flew in Osaka, and we had we were supposed to do this signing thing in this record store. So I go to the record store, and the manager of the record store hands me Mind Over Matter's Audio Manipulation. He goes, favorite record, can you sign? And I'm like,
what?
What the fuck,
Japan?
Man? Yeah, I was like, I've been here for like 10 hours, less than that. And
there's
this just happened. You know, that blew my fucking mind. It blew my mind. And, like, you know, you take those experiences into I've played Donington main stage, you know what I mean? Like, I've done some crazy shit for, you know, a guy who most people don't know. And it's like I, that always sits in the back of my mind, you know, like to try and appreciate what's going on in front of you, to be in that moment and just be like, this is nuts. This is absolutely nuts. So when I came off as arrogant with Aerotype, it was all kind of an act. It was all kind of stupid. Like, you know, I was really into Oasis, and I always thought that I was like, oh, I really want people to remember us, you know? And like, what I wasn't getting is that they should have remembered us for the music. And instead they remembered just hey, that band's pretty good, but that guy's an asshole. That was like the quote.
I think I remember the Mercury Lounge showcase. I can't remember if that was Aerotype or Instruction.
The Pilot the Gunner play?
Yes.
Yeah, that was Instruction.
Okay.
Yeah. That was when we first got signed to Geffen. Yeah.
You were funny at that show.
I wasn't drinking. We had a thing at that point where we because they wanted to keep me under, you know, in control, because we were now in this professional situation, like, everybody had an agreement that no one drank before we went on stage.
Wow.
That was the deal. And so I was very, I was lucid. I wasn't just being a drunk asshole. I was just an asshole. But
we skipped ahead, but I thought the Aerotype 11 stuff, you really took a swing. You know, those that Amplified to Rock record, like, those, that was a swing.
I like the Cranky Pete and I like the Game Face split. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it wasn't until after Amplified that the major started sniffing around, and there's probably 15 unreleased songs, which I think I'm going to get up on Spotify soon. Cause we're thinking about doing a show at the end of the year. And Adam was like, I think, you know, let's put these songs out. And I was like, all right, cool. And I listened to him and I was like, I don't know. A lot of them are just demos. We had every big producer produce demos for us.
Wow.
It was like, it was a whole thing.
And you have the rights for them.
I don't know who has the fucking rights, but sue me. I don't give a shit. How much money are you going to make?
Yeah.
Sorry. But, no, I mean, Atlantic
label guy
paid for some of them. Like, there was quite a bit. I mean, yeah, Atlantic has paid for a couple of my demos, actually. They did a Godfather's Man demo, too. And then gave it to us, which was super nice. But yeah, I didn't feel like, basically what was happening was people kept saying, like, the major started sniffing around, and I really felt like my voice was more suited to modern rock radio. And at the time, and I was just like, things had just changed. We went on, we toured on the first album cycle of the self-titled Airtight record, and my voice completely changed over that time because, you know, you play in basements and VFW halls night after night for that long. Your voice is getting, it was the first band I ever sang in, and well, besides a covers band, and my voice just got really gruff because I had to fucking scream over loud guitars and there were no monitors. Yeah. You know, it was just like, it was ridiculous. So like through that time, my voice really changed. We got to Amplified and they put a mic on me and it was like, who the fuck is this guy? And John Agnello, who did that record, he had this outboard gear that was like an automatic double track machine. And he actually taught me how to double my vocals really, really well. And he just had this, it wasn't an automatic double track machine. He had this EQ outboard gear that just fucking loved my voice. It sounded so warm and so good. So, and we were also layering and doing all this stuff that I had never done before. And he taught me how to do all this shit. And I have a really diverse voice. I can do a lot of different stuff. And so it got to the point where it was like, you know, the indie kids don't like us, you know, like they just, because we don't sound like an indie band, but the majors won't sign us because they think we're an indie band. You know what I mean? So it was really strange. And eventually, you know, Phil, our guitar player, quit after making, you know, 8 billion demos. And I was lucky enough that my roommate at the time was, he was the head engineer at the Magic Shop. So we were getting in Magic Shop all the time to record. And like on off hours for really cheap. And so Juan Garcia, he did, him and General George did a couple Sound Majority records and Brand New, some Take Back Sunday. Anyway, so Phil quit because he just wanted to get a job and get married. He had fallen in love. He was over it. And we took like a week and we were like, you know, let's keep going. And also we had all these unreleased songs. And I was like, well, we can try and shop some of this stuff. But, you know, I had this crazy idea that if Airtype 11 just changed their name, we would get a record deal immediately. Lo and behold, Tom joined the band, and we decided to go to England. We had toured as Airtype in England, and we opened for a band called 100 Reasons and a band called Hells for Heroes. And while we were on that tour...
I love 100 Reasons.
100 Reasons blew up. Like, we were going to play bigger venues because they were selling so many tickets. They were in the top 10. And I had met them because they recorded at Magic Shop, and they were fans of Airtype, and their management called us and were like, hey, could you go show these guys around New York? So we became friends. A band dropped off that tour. They invited us over. We did that tour. We made friends with their management in England. And it came back around where I was like, I got this band instruction. I was like, well, 100 Reasons is going to play The Underworld, which was a really big underplay for them, for a Christmas show. And like, do you guys want to do this? And he's like, you got to pay your own way. You know, like I will guarantee that like their booking agent and all these people are going to be there. Kerrang will be there. They'll review the show. Like maybe it'll be a good jumping off point for this new band you got. Like, all right, cool. So I put all fucking plane tickets on my credit card and we go over to England and we play this show at The Underworld and it was fucking awesome. And next thing you know, I get home and I get a call. Hey, you guys want to tour with Hells for Heroes in January? Yeah, of course we want to tour with Hells for Heroes. Now they're starting to blow up. And it was still like, it was mid-level venues, but fucking killer. And we're in England, which is like, you know, I'm a huge Anglophile. I'm like in heaven. And at that point, like we came back from the tour, we sold 3,000 EPs.
Wow.
In 3 weeks, just on the tour.
That was instruction,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And we had printed them ourselves and we sold them at the shows and we would sell them personally. We'd like stand at the door and be like, hey, £3. It was really cheap. That was the idea. I was like, well, it only costs us like a pound to make, so £3, whatever, we make a couple of bucks. We actually made our money back from that tour. I remember splitting up money with Adam because he had paid for some of it. And then we got home and they were like, hey, you want to go on tour with Funeral for a Friend? At this time, now granted, like I'm still working at a stock photography agency called Photonica, which has an office in London. So we would stay in Kingston and we would you'd go and play, and the bands always wanted to go home after, so we'd go back to Kingston after each show. I'd go to King's Cross, work for the morning, then go and play the show, and it was fucking Looney Tunes.
Wow.
But I wanted to keep my job, at least for that time. And I remember being at work, we got back from that tour, and then Kerrang wanted to interview us, and I did this interview where I said, And Ashley Bird, who was the editor at the time's biggest Glassjaw fan on the planet. So he was like really interested in anything that Long Island oriented. Yeah. And he interviewed me and I said, the quote was, we've only been a band for 3 months, but we're already better than 99.9% of the bands out there. And of course we were, because we were basically had been a band for 7 years. We just had one changed member, you know? And I mean, different drummers, whatnot, but Adam and I were still the core. And it was like, you know, and that was like the quote, you know, oh, they love no, that shit.
Of course. Yeah.
And UK, and so at that point I realized, oh, if I just say crazy shit, they'll print it. So we go back, we do this Funeral for a Friend tour. I think I, at some point we did a headlining show at the Underworld.
And this is mid-2000s.
This is 2002. And there was a picture on the inside, full page picture on the inside of Kerrang of me jumping off a bass drum. And I'm wearing like my Merciful Fate shirt and like I got my pants. I was so fucking poor. I had no clothes. Like my shoes were duct taped. My pants were ripped like this. Like, so in the picture, you can see me coming off and like my fucking underwear's hanging out. And it was like, yeah, it was crazy, but we knew something was going on. And we went back, we did that Funeral for a Friend tour. And then we got booked on Download Festival first year on the main stage. We were like, what the fuck? We had never done anything close to a festival, let alone a European festival. And we got booked on Reading and Leeds, which was a huge deal. In the meantime, I think Download Festival was right after, right before we got booked on a tour with Biffy Clyro, who are now huge. Massive. And at the time, I think that whole tour we played to like 50 to 100 people a night. And they were fucking incredible, life-changing band. At the time, they were way proggy and weird. They're very like, they still are sort of, but they're like a England's Foo Fighters now. And we would watch them soundcheck every day. They would jam for like an hour or two. And it was fucking mind-boggling how good this band was. And they were super young. And we were like, wow. We just thought we were going. And this is going to be it. And we did main stage at Download, which was 100,000 people, which was just a crazy day. Like, we played a little tiny club the night before. We slept on our drum tech's mom's floor. We got in to Donington at like 9 a.m. We did sound check. And it was this huge open field, this massive stage. Iron Maiden was the band that was on that stage the night before, which was so sick.
Wow.
I was like, oh my God, the tape's still here, the sound. Oh my God, I was freaking out. And we played this fucking crazy show. And we got off stage and we went. I went to the canteen, the cafeteria. And I was sitting next to Billy Corgan because Juan played. And so I was like, you know, I was just a pig in shit. And I'm just like down in beers. I'm like, fucking. I must have drank like 6 tall boys, no food, in like a half an hour. All of a sudden, we get a phone call from our booking agent. He's like, hey, this band Chevelle, you guys know these guys? I was like, yeah, they were, you know, whatever. We eventually had their management, Bill McGathy, but at the time, we didn't have any management or anything in America. And they're like, this band Chevelle didn't make their flight. Do you guys want to play again? You're on in 10 minutes.
What?
And this was on the second stage. So I go to the second stage, and we were supposed to use Flogging Molly's gear. Apparently, this was worked out, so we didn't bring any gear with us, except for our guitars and cables and shit.
So same festival.
Same festival.
Different stage.
Couple out, like maybe 2 hours later. And we were like, I get on, we walk up to Flogging Molly's crew, just taking the shit off. I'm like, well, guys, we got to use this stuff. We were told, like, no, you're not. And they fuck off. Fuck you, Flogging Molly. And you suck anyway. And fucking... so we have to get the gear over, and it was like mud everywhere. We get the gear on stage really quick. Hey, what's up? Hey, we're instruction. This song's called "Piss Me Off Again," and just like roll into the first song, and then when just the moments we were walking on stage, there was this huge curtain back behind the stage, and there were amps behind that curtain with Metallica's logo on them, and so. I got on stage with this in my brain, my drunken brain somehow, and we play the first song, and there was probably about, it was a huge tent, but there was probably maybe 7,000 people, which I know sounds like a lot, but in a situation like that,
yeah.
Looks kind of sparse. And I said, hey, I think you guys should, like all you people in the front here, I think you should stay. There's a bunch of amps with M's on them back there for, I don't know, Metallica. And there had been a rumor that they were going to play anyway. So... It like after I said that, there was 50,000 people in that tent, and we got within minutes. So we got to play a whole other set to like the main stage crowd, and then Brand New played, and then
after you,
and then Metallica played. Yeah,
wow.
And it was like it was totally wild. Yeah, and I went up to Jesse, after like Metallica was on stage and he's like moping around. He's like, and I wasn't sure if he knew. I can't remember the conversation I have because at that point I'm fucking wrecked and I'm just so psyched.
Yeah, like, you're about to see Metallica.
Like, fucking Metallica's playing. We just opened for Metallica. I didn't know this was going to happen when I woke up
Chevelle.
This morning. Yeah, thanks, Chevelle, who I eventually toured with and did thank him. But yeah, and it's actually in the Some Kind of Monster documentary.
Really?
Yeah, part of it. Yeah, it's
some of the festival shows. Oh, I need to watch that
again. It's a really short part of it, and I don't know if they even talked about, because it was ironic at the time that they played the Download Festival, whatever. And it was like the small stage. Give me a fucking break.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm talking to Jesse, and I'm like, dude, it's fucking sick. We just opened for Metallica. He's like, yeah, I'm not really a fan. He's like, I want to kick him in the nuts. Like, fuck you. Anyway, so.
How are you not a fan of just like one song or two songs?
It's not even a matter. You don't have to be a fan of the band. This is fucking sick.
Yeah.
Like, this is so cool. Like, do I like Metallica's later records? I don't give a fuck. But like
you're not throwing Lulu on anytime
right.
soon.
Right. You know, it's like opening for you too and be like, oh, I really like you too. Like, fuck you, you do too. It's part of the fabric of our fucking society, you know? Oh, the Beatles suck too, asshole. Go fuck yourself. Anyway, so I don't know. Yeah, I have no opinion about that band. Anyway, the brand new, that is, not the Beatles. I have a lot of opinions about them.
I just watched the documentary that Ron Howard did about their live years.
I didn't see it yet.
It's pretty rad.
Is it?
It's just about them
right.
touring.
That's got to be weird.
It's unreal. The footage they had.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can imagine.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Adam's, my old bass player, Adam Marino's dad was the cop who, like, I think if I remember correctly, this is the story. He might correct me about this, but was like one of the cops that was up in the hotels when they first came over and, like, you know, saw what was going on, you know, like girls up there and all this crazy shit. Fucking wild. Anyway.
The amount of shit.
Yeah, yeah. Adam Marino's dad was also friends with Joe Namath.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway.
I bet you guys have had some stories from Pop. Like,
yeah, you have no idea. I love that kid. But yeah, so then that happened, and we got 2 5K live reviews in Kerrang for the same day, which had never been done before. I played Download Festival 4 times, and for a while I was the person I played the most, and then they never asked us back after Gave Johnny Depp played there, which was a shit show. But anyway, so yeah, it was awesome. We got home, we moved to Los Angeles, we did a record with Bob Ezrin at Cherokee Studios, where they did Van Halen 1, 2, and 3 and
wow.
Led Zeppelin 3 and like what, you know, it was fucking wild. It was a crazy LA experience. You know, I was living in West Hollywood. It was fun. It was fun as shit. We recorded next to Sparta. So we spent a month next to those guys, and you know, shit like Stephen Perkins played on our record, like,
wow,
just shit like that. It was just
LA thing.
Total LA thing. Yeah, I mean, that shit happens a lot more out there because the people are just available.
How long were you out there?
Not long. I think we moved there in September. We were home by Christmas.
And that record came out on Geffen.
That record sort of came out. But yeah, I mean, basically,
I remember buying it at Tower on 4th
and
Lafayette.
Really? They waited way too long to put it out. And then they waited another year to put it out in England, where we were already popular.
Yeah. What?
Dude, these people are idiots. Everybody was like, and I'm sure there was internal stuff. I sat in a meeting, I kid you not, where, so DreamWorks and Interscope
together.
Geffen had combined, Universal. And so all the A&R people who didn't get fired came over, and the bands. So that's why Sparta, we were label mates with Sparta
right.
at that point. And so Rise Against A&R person, I can't remember her name. But I don't know why I sat in this meeting. Maybe it was like I was supposed to woo her into, like, hey, put
being
some money
into,
behind us.
Yeah.
But I knew it. I knew as soon as I knew that, like, they were, well, Jimmy cut all the budgets for rock bands because it's all about pop and hip hop. Because at that point, Jessica Simpson just hit, and, you know, 50 Cent and Eminem and all the shit. So, like, and rock bands has cost a lot of money to develop. And these bands was a fucking joke. It's like, you know, what is 4 faders going up on a fucking 50 Cent record? Yeah, so, like, I know that for a fact because I worked at Right Track Studio on 48th Street. Anyway, it's a fucking joke. Anyway, so, like, I would, like, just sitting in this meeting, and they were like, okay, we're deciding who's allocating money, who's going to get money behind them for this initial push, because our records came out around the same time. And they were just like, well, look, you know, these guys are going to sell 50,000 records automatically the first week, so because they were already established and we were a new band. And I was like, we're not a new band in England. I was like, what, you know, yeah, but that's a different company. And that was the problem. So Polydor over there.
Oh, and right. But
Polydor wouldn't do anything until Universal told them from America. It was like we got so fucking shafted, and we spent. So at that point, I was still in the middle of making my record. So I was, at that point, I was like, fuck this. I'm going to spend so much fucking money. I don't give a flying fuck about any, because I knew at that point that they were going to do a soft release and it was going to get fucked.
Wow.
And then we, like,
you
then
knew with, that before it was done.
Oh, fuck yeah. I mean, I didn't know, but I had a feeling. I had a real strong feeling.
Holy shit.
When they started saying the word soft release, I was like, there we go, guys. Wow. That's it. Like, soft release means you're doing everything yourself, and which is fine. We were used to that. But, you know, like, you're in the confines of this massive corporation, and it was. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to fucking, I had this song that I wrote that, and Bob Ezrin, who, for people who don't know, Bob Ezrin produced Pink Floyd, The Wall, and the first five Alice Cooper records and Kiss Destroyer and whatnot. And he's known for his grandiose string arrangements. And he, I was like, yo, I got this song. It's called Feed the Culture. It was an acoustic thing. I had done a couple of demos of it. It's in like this really wacky Led Zeppelin style tuning. I was like, it doesn't really fit the record, but I'd love to put like an orchestra on it and a sitar player. And like, he was like, Bob's like, yeah, like no big deal. I'm like, really? Oh, okay. So that was when we got Steve. I was like, I want a drum circle. He's like, we'll get Stephen Perkins. I was like,
wow.
And we did a drum. So we did a half an hour raga with Stephen Perkins and six other people. And like, oh, it was fucking awesome. I had so much fun. And we did a full string arrangement, which basically I was like humming to the guy what I wanted. And then they brought it back. And then it was like, I mean, we must have spent $40,000 on that song alone. And I was, fuck it. I don't care. I just want to, do something that I'm going to be so proud of. It's, and I don't care what people, and when the reviews came out of the record, AP gave a 1 out of 10, I believe.
I mean, that,
which,
I mean,
which was hysterical. Speaking of, we're on an emo fucking podcast, yeah. So I got to mention it.
Yeah.
I was bringing it up to Jonah Bear. I'm like, Jonah, did you write it? Tell me the truth. But
he's like overseeing it.
Oh, I'm sure he fucking wrote it. Fuck him. Anyway, I love him. And but yeah, he probably oversaw. They were like, no, the editor of AP called me, Jason Pettigrew, and he was like, he apologized personally. Yeah, he was like, we don't edit reviews. So, and I was like, dude, I've known you. Like, I knew him from past. And he showed up a show in Cleveland with the Brand X box set as a peace offering to me.
Wow,
which I thought was really sweet, because it was like. It was like, this band wants to be Creed. Why the fuck did I get this record? That was basically what it was.
And wow.
I was like, you obviously didn't read the bio, or you're too young to know who we are, you know, but like, that's fine. Whatever. I don't get that comparison, but you know, I wrote a radio rock record. Now that, like, where you say Airtype went for it, Instruction really went for it. And that was like, you know, and then subsequently when we got dropped, Godfire's Man was like still in sort of that world, you know. We were managed by McGathy and radio and all that shit.
That was a weird fucking time, though.
It was terrible. Because I mean, because that first Godfather's Man is my favorite record I've ever written.
Really?
Oh my god, it's fucking like, the songs are incredible. The band was great. Drew
so
Thomas.
That's your favorite stuff you've done?
Yeah, ever. Yeah. At the time, though, the whole time I was in Gay for Johnny Depp, so that was why we had false names, because I was signed to Geffen and we couldn't use it. And eventually, Joe, who was in Garrison, and the guitar player for Gay for Johnny Depp, he kind of like is Gay for Johnny Depp, joined Instruction after we did the record. So we were both in Gay for Johnny Depp and that, and we were touring simultaneously when we could, because, you know, nobody knows Gay for Johnny Depp over here, but in England, it was kind of a big deal for, you know, in that world. At
and
least.
That was around for a minute.
It was, yeah, we broke up in 2011. We went over to Europe to do Gross Rock Festival, not Gross Rock, Polka Pop, and there was huge storm and a bunch of people died. We were in Cologne waiting to go to Belgium to play this festival, and they canceled the festival, and we like put our tail between our legs. We're like, I think this is a sign. But you know, but that band was always a side project, and it probably sold more records than any band I've ever been in. So yeah,
wow. But the Godfire's Man time, 07, you know, that's when the Taking Back Sundays of the world and the hair, I mean, that kind of world was that.
Yeah. And we played. We opened for Thursday. We opened for Take Back Sunday. Like, we, you know.
Yeah, you're friends with all them.
Yeah. I mean, but it was, you know, I got Drew behind the kit looking like fucking Keith Richards, and you know, like we just didn't fit the suit. You know what I mean? Like we were weird looking. But the record, to me, that first one is great. The second one's incredible too. We recorded it, paid for it ourselves, put it out ourselves. We had no management. We had nothing. We just kind of, and we went to Europe and had a horrible tour. But like, yeah, it was, that was some of my favorite time because it was very, like you really, I went from a situation that was very business oriented and I'm just not me, you know, it's like I play because I love it and I still play because I love it. There's no money in it. There's never been any money in it. Even when I was signed to a major label and had an EMI publishing deal and all that shit, like, I mean, I lived on $33,000 for 3 years. And like, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're in that touring cycle, a lot of shit gets paid for. So I didn't have to spend a lot. But, I mean, the experiences that I had during that time were, you know, they would have never happened had I not signed to Geffen and done all that stuff. And it was just, like, incredible. I have lifelong friends that I met during that time, the same way I do from the underground days. And I still can go to England and play, and I just did with Primitive Weapons, opening for Dillinger, and see the same faces that I used to see back then. And there's so many kids with instruction tattoos in England.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
That's fucking super cool. Yeah. I saw this girl who I'd never met before and never saw after. She had a huge piece on her back. I was like, that's dedicated. I think I always play like these fatherly roles. I'm like, please don't do that again. Please.
Isn't that the thing? Like, got to keep them off the pole.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, man, it's crazy. Like, and at the end of Gave Johnny Depp in 2011 is when we opened St. Vitus. And
wait, can I talk about Unwed?
Oh yeah, of course, dude. I loved Unwed. Oh my god,
Hot Water plus Small Brown Bike.
Yeah,
hello.
Yeah, it was great. It was like basically Jason and I, Jason approached me, Jason and his wife Nelty, she was a singer. They approached me. He was like in the middle of playing on the Modest Mouse record and living in Seattle. He was in the middle of a divorce, and him and Nelty at that point were together. And then he moved to New York, which he fucking hated. I never understood why they lived in New York. I was like, Jason, you guys don't go out. That's the whole point of living in New York, is going out.
Do shit.
Right. Like, they don't drink. They don't eat meat. They make their own fucking soda. Like, they don't even go to coffee shops. Like, they're making their own. Like, it was like they lived in this really nice apartment, but they're really wonderful, wonderful people. And Jason and I have been friends for years. I'm friends with all the Hot Water guys. And I mean, I got stories from those tours. Oh my God. Those guys used to be fucking crazy.
Did you play 5:30? We're going to digress. Did you play 5:33 with them?
Who else was on the show?
Fuck. Because all I remember is the sound being
6:07 play?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I remember something happened with the stage. Like, the stage broke because too many people, and the sound guy got mad and ripped out everything. And I remember Chuck going and like doing the sound. Like, they were like sound checking, trying to figure it out again because the sound guy quit.
If this happened when Hot Water was on, sound guy quit. Nice.
Like, the sound guy quit during the show.
I'm sure Chuck had done sounded at the Hardback or something, so he got the experience. If Dreaming Hot Water music fishing was on stage, that usually means I was blacked out. So
why?
Because I'd already played and I was done. And I was going to get fucked up with Caleb, who plays in As Friends Rust, who was always out with them. Me and him would just get wasted and fucking act like assholes.
Some of the most fun shows I've ever been to have been Hot Water shows.
Dude, I mean, in those days when it was like just a free-for-all, their new video is great, by the way.
Oh, I haven't seen footage. It.
It's great. Yeah, like there's some footage from Vitus, actually, when they played with the Descendants. but like a lot of it is like Europe in the early 2000s and basement shows where it's just like sweaty and everybody's on top of each other. But yeah, Unwed was great. And Jason got in touch with me and they just wanted to write. He had a bunch of songs and he's like, you know, I know you're playing Primitive Weapons now and that's a way heavier thing. And, you know, like, you got any rock tunes you want to do? And, you know, Nelty was going to sing. And I had so many songs and I was like, I always wanted female vocals on them. And I was like, yeah, sure. And you know, eventually, of course, Nelty and I basically became co-lead singers. But she wrote 99, if not 100% of the vocal parts, but I wound up having to sing quite a bit, which I'm more than happy to do. You know, we wound up doing vocals with Brian McTiernan, recorded the record at Vitus in the live room, and yeah, it was just super fun. I mean, we brought in Matt Cain, who played with in Big Collapse with Josh Luca.
Yeah.
And
wait, what was he again? He was the
he's a guitar player.
Guitar player, yeah, yeah.
He was actually, oddly enough, the assistant engineer on the first Aerotype 11 record. Yeah.
Wow.
Totally weird. But I knew Matt for years, and Jeff I didn't really know, but I knew Jeff because he had a King Crimson tattoo, and we bonded because I have a Yes tattoo, or multiple Yes tattoos. And I was like, yeah, cool. He's like, I don't even really like this. I just like the design. Because typical Jeff, he's everything's got to be fucking sarcastic and weird. that band was weird because I was the only person that didn't drink, that did drink. They all, were all sober. And so touring was super fun with them. I had no responsibility. It would just be like, I know I'm not driving. Peace, guys. But the band was really good. The album is, I think the album is fantastic. It didn't really get, I don't know if it didn't get a push or just like, you know, Hot Water fans weren't feeling it or like what the case was, but I'm super proud of it. And,
cool.
You know, I miss those guys a lot. They Nelty and Jason moved back down to Florida. So did Matt. So everybody's kind of all over the place now. But
yeah. What's, I think, cool about all of these bands and all of these stories is that it really does lead to St. Vitus and the connections and the, I mean, that's how, that's why I'm sitting here. I didn't sit here because I'm good at my job. I'm here because I'm friends with a lot of people and I've stayed in touch with them. And at some point you're going to see them again.
Yeah. I mean, that's always the best way to be. Like, you know, even on the major label level, I'm still, you know, I still have lunch with Bill McGathy. He used to be my manager. Like, you know, like I still see all these people and like, you know, I go to a show, they're managing Biffy Clyro over here now. I went to see Biffy and, you know, it's all these people that say, hey, Artie, you know, it's like, I should have been more of an asshole in that time, to tell you the truth, like on the major label version of my bands. Cause I would have gotten more done. Maybe that was just being the nice guy was the wrong approach. But I wasn't. And, cause I'm not like the business guy, you know what I mean? Like I just wanted to play music and have people hear my songs and tour and, you know, maybe eke out some sort of a living where I could pay my rent. And you know, Vitus,
it's not like you just came in from Duluth and opened it
right.
up.
Well, you can't do that.
And you've got
that's a recipe for failure. I mean, you see people do that shit in New York all the time.
I'm going to come to New York and take over.
You can't do that in LA. You can't do that in New York. You can't do it in Boston. Like there are certain places that you have to have some sort of background there. And there, I mean, there's
and you have to sustain it.
Right.
It's a place where it's rent's expensive. It's like you got to have people there and groups of different people through the night. Like
I mean, people don't understand how much pressure there is with the overhead, and the overhead gets higher and higher as you're open longer. Part of the success of Vitus, and I say success because
you're still open after 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, and as we both know, the way that venues work, it's almost impossible. And here in New York, it's like literally 1,000 times harder than any place else. Not because you can't get people to come, but because the city has so many regulations and there's so many things that can go wrong. You know, with more people comes more opportunity for things to go wrong. But also because we're actually from here, which helps. And the place sounds great. It looks cool. And it, you know, it eventually after a couple of years became the place that people had to play. You know, I saw the Gojira shirt out there. I mean, like that was a wild show. You know, Dillinger in our little space was sick. It was a throwback to the old days for them. You know, Hot Water and Descendants, which was one of the worst and best days of my life. I don't get to have fun ever. So, like, none of this shit is fun for me. I just want to make sure everything happens and nothing goes wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's it's exciting and you can be proud when you look back at the pictures or the videos, which there's videos of almost every show that's ever happened.
But I just love that all these band things, I feel like you wanted to like be this like big music and make records and you are, but they didn't have like that major label or like million sellers. You weren't.
I just wanted one song. Just give me one fucking song.
I know you wanted one song.
So I can keep making a couple of checks.
All you need is one song.
I know. It's all you need is one song, especially in the 90s. The amount of mediocrity that made money in the 90s was fucking unbelievable.
No, you just needed one song. But I still think the culmination of this part, this is the it led to this, though.
Absolutely. And you know,
I love that.
I got into bartending because I had no other choice. And within 5 years, I owned a place. And it's you know, that's a pretty good record. And I mean, it was, the timing was really good for metal. Honestly, you know, I think we got lucky with that. There's definitely been a downturn.
And that's a loyal audience.
It is, but there's definitely been a downturn. There's, you know, it was pretty hip 3 years ago, you know, whether it be fashion-wise or whatnot. And there were a lot of bands, and the industry's changed so drastically where people don't sell records, and bands are touring more, so they're coming through more. And so it's like less and less people. You just can't do it. You know, you can't expect 250 people to show up every time you play. You know, if you just played 3 months ago, it doesn't work on like the, hey, we're building our crowd type way. It doesn't work that way anymore. It's like you start here and then you start going down, and then you got to figure out a way to sort of
maintain
it. It's sad to me to see. But, you know, like we've also, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we saw the writing on the wall. We were like, yo, like we can't live on metal alone. We won't be able to pay our bills. So we need to start diversifying. And a lot of that revolved around, sort of, you know, there is an association, but starting to have more of the bands, like we had Descendants and Hot Water, which was by happenstance that happened. But like,
I mean, you just had the Van Pelt.
We just had the Van Pelt. We've had Mineral with Frank Turner going on first, which was hysterical. He's an old friend of mine.
Frank and I had an episode where we just talked about nu metal.
Oh yeah, dude, I'm sure. Because that's probably what he listened to when he was young. Yeah.
It was really fun.
He's about the right age.
Yeah.
And like fucking Quicksand, you know, that was a huge one for me personally.
I mean, obviously having the...
I didn't enjoy it because I did the lights.
But having the, you know, having the remaining members of Nirvana, you know, that night.
Yeah, I mean, that was just like, that's so far beyond everything that has gone on. I mean, you know, maybe... I can't even say, like, the second biggest band we ever had was Megadeth, you know, and like, it's not even close, you know, like the Nirvana thing, especially since like Jay Mascis and Joan Jett you know, I don't know if I should tell the story or not, but cause I told it so many times. I feel like people, everybody knows the story, but then I'm like, wait, how many people are we talking about here really in reality that know this story? But yeah, Nirvana and Friends, quote unquote, played, and it was after the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Dave Grohl was looking for a place to throw like an after party, and you know, I made a hard sell. I got a phone call on April Fool's Day about it.
Really?
And I thought it was a joke, and I didn't call the guy back because he didn't say it was this guy JC who manages the Foo Fighters, and he didn't say from the Foo Fighters office or Dave Grohl's office. He just said, hey, this is JC, looking about a show. Like, and no one calls us about a show. They email us, you know? And I was like, oh, this LA number. I don't fucking know who this is. And then he called back again.
LA number.
And he called back again and he said he was from Dave Grohl's office. And I was like, oh, this has got to be a fucking joke. And I was at Restaurant Depot, like, getting plastic cups and,
yeah,
and limes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
limes.
I listened to the message and I was like, and I played it for my partner was sitting in the car with me, and I was just like, and he's like, dude. And then I got a text message right at that moment, like from my friend. He's like, if you get a call from LA, call it back or answer the phone. And I was, and I knew who she was. She worked for Dave Grohl's company. And I was like, pull over, call them back. And at the same time, the booking agent for the Foo Fighters was calling Dave. Because they were, at this point, I guess they were frustrated.
Look, Artie's being a dick.
Yeah, I'm being a dick. So I talked to him and I was just like, yeah, like, well, we got another venue. And I'm pretty sure it was between us and the Bell House. And the Bell House is closer. And I was like, well, you know, I really feel like Dave will love our place, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's like metal and, you know, Probot and whatnot. And then as it turned out, it was this guy, Jim Rhoda, who works for his production company. They were doing Sonic Highways at the time, the whole documentary.
Yeah.
And Jim Rhoda had played Vitus in a band called The Company Band, which has like a guy from Clutch. And he used to be in, I'm such an asshole. Not Peter and Test Tube Babies. I'm such an asshole. I can't remember. Anyway, Norman Bates and Showerheads. Although he wasn't in that band, he was in the band after that. Anyway, so we had done a benefit for one of the guys in his band who died. And he played in Company Band, and he was just like, I love this place. I've been telling Dave about it. This is the day of I found out all this stuff. And he was the one who really pushed for it to happen with us because he knew Dave would love the place. And yeah, so we knew about it for about 4 days. Only three of us knew about it. And we didn't tell anybody. We just told the whole staff to show up that night.
We need you tonight.
Yeah, it's like, everybody show up. We'll tell you what's going on when you get here. And that was pretty much it. And, it went off. They played from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. Everybody was really, really super nice, maybe a little drunk. There was maybe 150 people, if that, probably less. It was really sparse. Jay Maskus was fucking amazing.
Sparse meaning that
there was not that many. By that time, all those people had been at the Hall of Fame thing all night. So we let about 40 people in who we knew, who showed up, who knew about it, which filled in the crowd really nicely. And actually it was good because they were actual fans. So they were like, not only were they like, oh my God.
So you didn't announce anything.
No, we couldn't. Are you kidding me? That was my biggest worry, is that somebody who got an invitation was going to tweet about it. We were going to have another Descendants situation with 1,000 people outside and at 2 o'clock in the morning, we were going to get closed down. So it was a really, really tight secret. And it was Dave's party. So, and they were incredibly great. I mean, he hired a photo booth guy. Well, his company did. The photo booth guy didn't even know about it. He had no clue why he was there.
Wow.
He's like, it's some party or something. I was like, yeah, Nirvana's playing, dude. He's like, what?
Wow.
I was like, yeah, just be on time.
Just chill out for a second.
This was at about like 10 o'clock that I told him, I think. Anyway, and the band that played that night, is it Girlfriends or Boyfriends or something? They were total dicks. They were all pissed off at us, but whatever.
I was like, whatever. The world will keep turning. The
guy did interviews afterwards and was like, and I liked the band too. It bummed me out. But he talked shit about us from stage. He was like, I was going to tell them all to stay. And we put up signs and said, that we were like, look, guys, the show's got to be over by 11, which is not a big deal, honestly, on a weeknight.
It's 11.
Yeah.
You didn't tell them 9:30.
And we, we didn't cancel the show, which is what originally was going to happen.
Yeah.
And like, the guy was just like, he reminded me of myself in the late 90s, honestly, like just bitter and shitty. So, like, he did a couple interviews afterwards and, like, said that we were dicks and we kicked him out. We threw their shit on the sidewalk. And
that's probably his ego.
Yeah, I mean, it was weird. Whatever. He was like, oh, is Guns N' Roses shooting a video tonight? Better be Guns N' Roses. And I was, like, laughing. I'm in the booth. I'm like, dude.
Even
but he
better.
Said shit like, it wasn't the real Nirvana, whatever. Like, shit like that. It was like, dude, you could have come and if you stayed, you would have had fun, but you wanted to be a dick. Fly back to Austin and go fuck yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Time.
Anyway, it was a wild experience, and that was really like, we had already done a bunch of late night shows like Cervella Talk, and I think Against Me was after that, but it was after that happened that we became now the spot to do that. So like Against Me Saves the Day, the list is long. We haven't done one in a while, but
Remember we tried.
With who?
I tried to get Jimmy Eat World to do it.
Oh, with Jimmy Eat World. Oh, dude, that would have been so sick. Yeah. I mean, hey, fellas, Jim, come down, jam.
They said if they didn't, that Zach told me, he said we would be totally into it if there was some scheduling thing where they need like a certain day off.
Right.
And they were like, we fucking jammed it too much.
Yeah.
But I
understand that if the night that Descendants and Hot Water played, I wanted Hot Water to play that night. And they were like, dude, we got to drive to Toronto tomorrow. We have an overnight. So there was just no way.
Yeah.
And then the show got canceled and it all worked out. But I mean, obviously we understand that with routing. And if you can't do it, you can't do it.
Yeah.
But,
But even that they like, I think it's known and I don't think it's sticky either because it's a different vibe.
Oh, yeah.
And, I think, I mean, I remember this wasn't your venue, but Refuse did the Archeron. That like,
right.
Sort
the
of,
first
like,
time they did one.
That was like... that same kind of feeling, I'm sure.
Well, we were supposed to have that show.
What happened?
We had Young Widows that night.
Oh.
Like, it was, we couldn't do it.
That's
we already
why.
Had a sold out show.
I'm sure Rich hit you up first.
Yeah, I mean, well, Rich was working for us at the time. But yeah, I mean, I was happy for whoever got that, and we were all friends with those people, so it was...
But it was a different show. They got to play an Earth Crisis cover that wouldn't have made sense in front of 4,000 or 30,000
right, and
people.
When they played our place, they did all covers. It was...
That was awesome.
It was amazing. It was so much fun.
Thanks for getting me in.
Dennis didn't... I met Dennis in 1994 in Piteå, Sweden, and the Donuts opened for us. Not the Do-Nots, the Donuts, the Victory girl band. This is Mind Over Matter, and then nobody would talk to us because we drank, and it was really funny. And Refuse wasn't a big deal at the time.
Yeah,
we were
no.
like, sick of it all cover band, basically. And the like all those Scandinavian bands back then, they all fucking sounded like somebody from New York. I don't think there'll ever be a time where I don't want to play music and get on stage. And I, with Vitus, I got really lucky to be able to incorporate all the things that I, all the skills I had gained. Like, you know, you don't realize, until you own a venue, you don't realize what you learned during all that time of touring, you know? And even the design of Vitus is a culmination of all these European metal bars that I had been in. And, you know, like, this is what we want to do. And it wasn't even supposed to be a fucking venue, but that was the only way to get people into to go to Outer Greenpoint. Because I think metal and punk and hardcore, like, we all want more people to come into our fold. And I, you know, I don't care when you got into it. You could have gotten into it last year. As long as you're into it, that's cool.
You know, it takes a little bit to do it.
Well, it's a youth culture too, you know? So it's like you tend to get people who are in their teens, you know, early 20s that are just, you know, their brains are still developing and they're absorbing all this stuff. And so like it's, you know, as you get older, it becomes more of a nostalgic thing. It's weird, but I'm really, you know, like I said, I'm lucky to have been able to realize that I did gain these skills. I know what bands want when they roll into town. That's a big skill. Believe
yeah.
it or not. You know, like, and I know how I wanted to be treated, and it's all very European. Like, the way they do it over there is so much better. And granted, a lot of the, you know, because of social democracy, it's easier. You know, New York is just a fucking jungle, and they want to find any way to shut small businesses down. They'll do anything. It's fucking bullshit. It sucks.
Wow.
It's like really, really difficult to keep, to get liquor licenses, to get permits, to get any of this shit. And it's all because, like, this is, you know, like when places like CBGB's opened, it was a shithole here. So you could do anything you wanted. And now it's a playground for the rich. And Brooklyn is as well. So once those people start moving in, they don't want the, you know, undesirable type places to be there. But I think secretly they do. So, you know, we've survived. And I feel lucky that I've had music in my life, because I'm a music nerd. That's what I do. You know, like, Yes is my favorite band. You know, I grew up on metal. Ask me anything about Discord. You know, like...
You're a huge Britpop head.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we didn't even get into that. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Ask me anything about Britpop. Jesus. But, like, I just love music, and so it really, that's when people always say, like, oh, you love Oasis? I'm just like, dude, I love everything. You know, and I feel like that was really a big difference between Airtype and the other emo bands at the time, was that we were coming from, at least I was coming from, a classic rock type feel. You know what I mean? Like, I was into hardcore, but I never really had this urge to want to play music like that. But I like the energy of it, and I like, love the community and the scene. But, you know, I was busy listening to early 70s prog records, and, and, you know, like, I always, like, when people shave their heads, I grew my hair long. When people grew their hair long, I shaved my head. Like, it was always this contrarian type thing, you know, looking like, in 1994, looking like, you know, Damon Albarn or Liam Gallagher was kind of not cool, you know, and at least in the hardcore scene. But eventually it did become cool, you know, it was like, that's what everybody was listening to. Everybody, you know, all of a sudden everybody's like, Ride's my favorite band. I'm like, really? You know, Cast. Cool. But I've been through all of that stuff, and I just love it all. It's like, you know, there's nothing. And I also, you know, people who play in bands, it's like, there's a lot of effort that goes into it. The songwriting, the rehearsing, going to play a show, playing shows, just the only part about playing a show that's good is being on stage. Everything else fucking sucks.
Yeah, it's 45 minutes of awesome, and then the rest is...
I used to love it. And then I had roadies. And now, yeah, the whole, like, sitting around, because all I'll do is get drunk. It's like, oh, God, if I got nothing to do, I'm going to do this. But then I can't get drunk, because then I'm going to suck. And, like, it's...
Yeah.
Oh, my life is so hard. But yeah. If they could create, like, a transporter... That'd be awesome. Like, hey, I want to play the Underworld tonight in Camden. All right, cool.
I'm there. Oh, I didn't have to get on a plane.
Wasn't there a Portlandia episode where they put on those virtual reality? Oh, no. They put on helmets and they didn't want to go to the festival. So there was a drone that was there for them to watch the festival for them. So they're in these like headset like things and watch the festival from the drones.
That's the future, isn't it? It's the present.
But they didn't have to go to the festival. They could just go through the drones.
Right. Yeah. That's amazing. But dude, that's going to happen. That's going to fucking happen. It's just crazy. Like, and it's funny when I meet, so this is a good story that pertains to sort of late 90s emo stuff. So Airtie played open for Shiner at Gramercy Theater. Shiner are old friends of ours. We had played with them a bunch in the early 2000s. I fucking worship The Egg. I mean, what a fucking incredible record. I love Life and Times too. Everybody should buy their new record. And I was, I was 5 o'clock in the morning hanging out with Josh Newton at Vitus. He used to live down the block. And he's like, oh, I think we're going to play some shows. And I was like, do two nights here. It's like, all right, cool. Yeah, totally. That's great. Well, then all of a sudden, you know, I don't know who got involved, some fucking booking agent. And it's like, oh, it's at Irving Plaza. Like Airtype and Shiner. I was like, who the fuck think that's a good idea? And then it got moved down to Gramercy. And it was good. It was a good turnout. It was super fun. They were incredible. But in the meantime, I found out that Braid was going to play, I think they played Music Hall maybe, and then they were going to play Vitus at late night. And I think it was something that they wanted to use another band's gear. They didn't want to show up with gear. So it was like, all right, cool. Like Airtype will play. We'll get in the car. We'll just roll over after the Gramercy show. So we get in the car. Of course, we get stuck in insane traffic. It takes us an hour and a half to get from Gramercy to Vitus.
Oh.
Right. And we were really late. There is like 500 people in the building. It was Looney Tunes. We couldn't get the gear through the crowd. Finally get up there. And it's running late, so we only did a few songs. We did 5 songs. And I got on stage, and I was like, the first thing I said, I was like, so we're Airtype 11. You can watch. You have to sit through us to get to Braid. If you don't want to watch us, go to the bar and drink. Either way, I win. And so we start playing, and all these kids who were sort of like metal kids who were, you know, living in Brooklyn, and like, they're all fucking singing along. They had no idea that I was in Airtype 11.
Really?
Yeah. And like, there's all these fucking kids. I was like, what the fuck? It got to that part in Better Than the Super Bowl, and I was like expecting no one to sing. And I could hear people singing along. So I was like, all right, I'll take the risk and I'll step back from the mic. And I stepped back and the whole crowd started singing. And I was like, yes. But I got off stage and people were like, dude, I had no fucking idea. I was like, that's so weird.
How did they not know? You have the internet. Don't they have the internet?
I don't know, man. They probably hadn't thought about it in years. And they, you know, maybe they were there to see Braid. They might have just been there to hang out. But like, as soon as
started
playing.
It is the right demo. It is the right age.
It is the right. It's perfect. Yeah. So it was that was really super cool. Really eye opening to me. Musically, it's hard to have goals. Business wise, I have a lot, and you know, I've definitely transitioned in my head and out of necessity, because St. Vitus is really the first thing I've ever done that I was successful on a business level. You know,
that's what I meant. But it came the culmination from all those other things. Which, yeah. I guess is always it, but it's something with music where you're able to use almost everything you've done since the first time you met Ed at the show.
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally, you know, and threw Ed out of the band, yeah. Although that wasn't me. Although he'll always claim
but
it was
But being
me.
Like, you met him and then it's, you know.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember the first time we recorded demos of Matter of Matter, you know, it was like crazy. It's like you don't realize. I think other people talk about songwriting and they just think it's like this magical thing, you know. It's like, what? It's so like they in their brains they can't imagine writing a song. Like I can't imagine painting a painting because I'm not good at it. But songwriting is like certain people just do it naturally, you know. Certain people do it naturally and really terribly, and and certain people do it really well. A lot of people do, actually. That's one of the shames of the internet is that there's so much stuff that falls wayward, and there's so many people. I look at music very much like I look at the tech world or science, where they lose the brightest and the smartest to the business world because there's more money in it. And, you know, like nobody wants to sit in a lab or develop things, or like, you know, it's same thing with music, where you have these really talented people, but there's an outlet, but
if they have like one failure or it just takes too long to get there, they're going to have a backup plan and they'll just disappear into whatever work that they do. And they'll never have that chance that we took to get in a van and go for years and develop and get better and, you know, realize what works and what doesn't. And it's, cause you can't do that from the fucking computer screen, you know? Yeah, it's weird. I mean, somebody brought this up to me the other day. Like, do you think there'll ever be a time when there just isn't bands anymore? And I was like, there might be, you know, that might happen, or it might just get so small and that people can't be bothered, or it's not viable for on a monetary level. And you know, with virtual reality, maybe live music won't be a reality anymore. You know, like people will just be looking in a headset. I think things are moving at light speed right now on the tech side of the world. And you know, if we make it through this North Korea thing,
Jesus Christ.
We'll,
I keep looking out the window, you know,
I know, right. They can't reach us. It's okay.
Okay.
It's Guam or California, probably Alaska. But yeah, it's weird. I don't know where it's going or where, you know, but it seems like people are going to, I hope not, but live music will always exist, but it's going to be in a different format. Maybe it'll be a drone in a festival. Maybe it'll be just live streaming, which live streaming is great, but it's not a perfect thing because of,
I still want to feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing. Getting the sound right on live streaming is not, it's definitely not the same. It's not even close. We've done our share of live streaming. But I think people have become more and more homebound too, you know, like they just don't leave. It's like, well, why should I leave? I could just watch the show on YouTube, you know, the day after it happened. And so, yeah.
That's what I meant by, it kind of goes full circle of like, I didn't know anything when I was going to those shows.
It's just, it's all gone. All that shit's gone. So there's no point in lamenting about it. It's just like, okay, how do we move forward? How do we adapt? How do we deal with it? You know, like I was listening to your Kevin Lyman podcast, and it was interesting. It's interesting to me that it's still going, but like it's, you know, this, the way he talked about how he does things, it's very old school, you know. I think they got a little boost from that Dickies thing this summer, but
yeah,
you know,
that was weird.
I fucking, you know, Shayna from Warren Woman, she's cool. Like that. I mean, I think they take that shit a little far, but I mean, that's the point. You know, I like that somebody's being protesting and speaking up and doing like the, you know, the tradition of punk rock, you know. I think they took it too far with the Dickies. It's just like, who fucking cares? I was like, the Dickies? Really? Like, who the fuck cares?
Yeah.
You know, like, let this guy say what he wants. Penises. I mean, yeah, he reacted poorly. And, you know, thank God the internet didn't, and the iPhone didn't exist when I was younger. I would be a lot different. But yeah, it's like just, like, give me a break.
Yeah.
But they used it as a platform for women's rights and feminism and, you know, harassment. And the reality of it is that, you know, I don't think I've ever dated a girl in my life who hasn't been abused in some way. So that's fucking sad. And so people need to get that information out there. You know, maybe somebody will think twice before they do something stupid. You know, I don't know. I don't have the mindset. I don't understand how these things happen, but like it's, yeah. Anyway, it's a depressing subject. Let's end on something positive.
No, we're good.
I can get back to Park Slope and have a happy hour before I go pick up my daughter.
No, we're good. I'm happy that you were able to do this, and I'm happy that you're still making music and doing bands and having different goals, and it isn't, there's other, it just seems like there's a lot going on, and I just feel like there's a great culmination of all the, your time in it. It wasn't wasted. Like, I know some people will be like, why are you going to those shows? Why are you buying those t-shirts? Why are you getting all those CDs? Well,
this is what, I don't sleep at night because I'll just sit there and think about how much time I spent sitting around waiting to play, or, you know, like, and not like, you just like, I could have been in college. I could have done this. I could have done that. And it's like, you know, and then there's the other side of the coin, is it that, well, you do this now and this is the culmination of all those experiences. And, you know, I know that like, there's this thing called the experience, what is it called? The experience economy, that like is the new thing now, where millennials want an experience. They don't want to buy things, whatever. Anyway, I listen to way too much podcasting shit. But it's, I think that that was incredibly valuable, you know. And my parents, my mom's left the country once in her life. My dad never has. Like, I've seen things. Like, my dad just called me when I was in Oslo, and he's like, he called me like three times. I was like, oh, something happened. I wasn't going to answer, and I answered. I'm like, he's like, hey, where are you? I'm like, I'm in Oslo, Norway. He's like, what? Like, it, you know, it doesn't know a fucking clue what I'm doing. But that's cool, you know. Those are experiences that I wish everybody could have. You know, play in front of 100,000 people. You know, go to Japan.
Yeah, traveling.
But, yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, that was all I wanted to do, and playing music was a really great excuse to do that. You know, in retrospect, then, like, you should balance it out with going to school and developing some sort of career. That's the advice I would give to anybody. It's like, don't throw everything in the, you know, all your eggs in one basket and go, I'm going to be a rock star. Like, no, you're not, because that doesn't exist anymore. You know, like you, maybe you could become a YouTube star or something. I don't know. I don't know how much money there is.
Or a YouTube star. You never know.
Yeah. Or YouTube. Yeah, exactly. But, but yeah, it's like, I just, like, that shit doesn't exist anymore. So I often, like,
have plan B.
Please have a fucking plan B. Jesus.
See?
Like, I got lucky and it's funny because I'd love for somebody to do like an article or something on what the people, like, say, like all the guys in The Promise Ring, or like the guys in Get Up Kids, or the guys in a band like 6 Kona 7, or some of like the lower tier stuff. Like, what are all those people doing for a living now?
Well, it's crazy. I mean, Promise Ring, like, Davey's an accountant. Dan from Drummer's been producing the Jawbreaker doc that premieres tonight. He's like, he does post-production. It's like, I don't know, everyone's kind of like, because sometimes I have this, like, you know, you have a view of what someone is, and you're like, right. Well, they're a drummer in a band. No. And then, no, they have
no,
this
they
other
were fucking
thing.
Smart, and they went to college. Yeah, I remember touring with Snapcase, and those guys would only tour in the summertime because they were all in school. Now, what the fuck? Fuck that shit, man. Like, you guys are in a huge band. Like, you know, they were, to me, that was huge. It's like, fuck going to college. It gives a shit. And, you know, lo and behold, I'm sure they're all fucking doing something.
I mean, you know? Eamon from Karate is a doctor.
I mean, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, I know plenty of people who became lawyers and shit like that.
But see, here's the lesson. Fall back.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of dedication. It's on that, but when you, again, it's like, it depends on what time in your life you're doing it, and you can't predict when you're going to have your moment. You know, I think you're working at a record label, you probably know this really well. Where it's like, unfortunately, for a lot of songwriters, they get better as they get older, but they'll only get the money to promote themselves when they're younger. So their material might not be their best. And then their best record comes out when they're either dropped or they can't get a record deal, but they're fucking, you know, they've gotten to this pinnacle of songwriting, but it doesn't matter if there's nobody to push you and no one to fucking make it happen. And I've seen that happen. I feel like that happened to me. And, you know, I see it happen to lots of people, where you pick up a record and you're like, oh, this is fucking incredible, you know, but no one's going to care because this isn't the height of the emo moment, or, like, you know, the height of nu metal, you know what I mean? Like, and no one's going to get behind you on it. And it's, and to tour, forget it, you know, like, it's so expensive and the chances you're going to make your money back are so minimal. So it, you know, if you could still, like, to all the bands who got under the radar and get back together now, more power to you. If you broke up before like 2005 and you actually sold some records, like, people are bugging out about this Jawbreaker thing you know, just like, I saw them play at ABC in Rio, where they said that they would never sign to a major label. But I got why they did, and it's cool. Who gives a shit? You know, to each his own. Let fucking people live their lives and your stupid fucking rules that aren't real.
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking ridiculous. What you like is not real. What you're thinking is not real, okay? Just
and if the band wants to do it, the band wants to do it.
Band wants to do it, exactly. Like, you know.
You're not in the band.
Like, how long can you eat shit for? At some point, you want to, like, not eat shit. Or even when you sign to a major label, you're still eating shit. It's fucking, give me a break. But, like, it's, you know, people bugging out, oh, like, they're reuniting and blah, 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 and all this shit. And it's like, yeah, so what? They want, let them. If I could fucking, one of my bands could reunite and play fucking Riot Fest headlining, oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
You would be there in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
You'd be there for four, five
I mean, there
seconds.
Are some reunions that I agree with, and there are other reunions where I look at it and I go, take the paycheck away from that, and that wouldn't happen. Shelter.
Yeah. Don't you think all of them are about money, though?
Youth of Today.
Which one?
Youth of Today.
Well, obviously, every there's a kid that is born in Germany right now that in 12 years is going to be a youth crew kid and is going to want to see Youth of
Today.
Is
he really?
What?
Is he really?
Yes.
Are you sure? Ray's going to be like 65.
I
talked to Walter about this, and he was like, I'm going to do it forever, man.
Yeah, as long as there's a flight over there.
Take the money out of it. Take the money out of the equation. I'd like to see those guys play and not get paid. I'd like to see it.
You're never going
to
do that, though. You want pay? You want to get paid?
I don't give a shit. You kidding me? I played that show at Vitus for free. I fucking, if we do a reunion, you know.
How
again,
about the, I meant like overall, not like one show or one thing. I'm saying like the overall thing. Like, you want to make something out of it. You got to live, right?
At this point, I don't give a fuck. Unless I'm sacrificing,
okay,
you know,
something else.
Like a lot of time and whatnot. But like, yeah. But at the same time, I know I'm not, like, if Gave Johnny Depp did a reunion, which we've talked about endlessly, and we went over to England, we could probably sell out a couple of shows. But would we cash in? No. We'd be paying back our plane tickets.
Yeah.
And the gas and the van. And, you know, it's like, it's none of that shit has changed. Those bands are on a different level. A band like Judge is getting paid like 15 grand a show.
Wow.
You know, it's like, and again, those guys are all awesome people. And it's cool. But I always say with these, especially with these youth crew bands and all this shit, that these guys are in their fucking 50s. Take the money out of the equation. Would you do it? And like, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't answer. Or they'd say, yeah. And okay, cool. Go play a benefit show right now. What do you want to benefit for? Take a flight over to wherever, you know, and play a benefit show. It's like, no, they can't do that. They're somewhat professional, you know? So it's, I don't know. It's
I
funny.
Can't believe youth bands are still playing. I always think my Twitter feed's messed up, or I'm opening a website that's like from back in the day when I see like a show announcement.
Yeah. Me too. I'm just like, this is like, yeah, is this like somebody putting an old flyer up?
Is this an Onion article?
Yeah.
Or Hard Times now?
Hard Times, yeah. No, it's, but at the same time, again, like I do say more power to them. You know, if you can do it and people will come, you know, the money's a bonus. That's great. Again, I think for certain people that the money is not a motivating factor, but if you took it away, it wouldn't be the same.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I look at, like, when Frank Turner came and opened for Mineral. Granted, he's a rich guy now, but he, you know, he did, Mineral donated $500 for his plane ticket. He was going to play for free. Like, that's cool, because he just wanted to play.
Oh, he flipped out. I mean, that's like...
Oh, he was so psyched.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, like, seeing that excitement at a guy at his level... You know, that's fucking ace, man. That's really, like, there's a reason why people clamor over him and whatnot, because he is the real deal. There's nothing bullshit about him. Yeah, he grew up privileged and all that other shit, but he's also an incredibly smart guy, you know? And, like, so you kind of forget about that real quick. It's like, and who cares what your upbringing is? It's what you are now. So, you know, it's...
So doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. You know, worked his ass off.